I'm Larry Rasmussen, and this is the fifth in the series on Jesus and power. We've talked about several forms of power through the week, and we have tried in each instance to make some connections between our observations and experience of those kinds of power and what we see in and around Jesus. We've talked to date about power as coercion, power as ideology, and in that connection, sociology, and power as nurture. Today, the topic is power as cosmic energy. Now, I'm the least sure about getting hold of this kind of power and relating it to Jesus. At the same time, I have an instinct that this is the most fundamental kind of power, and that it is the one we ought to give much more attention to as we talk about Christian faith and as we focus on what is happening there in the Jesus movement than we do. So I'm on the one hand convinced, if you will, at least tentatively, that this is the most primordial expression of power and thus merits our attention in a major way. And on the other hand, I am least sure about the connections, which is usually the occasion in which you turn a presentation into a discussion at Holden Village, because none of us is smarter than all of us. As the saying goes, all of us together are smarter than any one of us individually. I always remember Reinhold Niebuhr, he didn't put it this way, but it's consistent with his theology that the contrast is also true. None of us individually is as dumb as all of us are when we do dumb things together. But we're going to go with the none of us is as smart as all of us together. I do have some comments to try to frame a discussion, but then this is genuinely exploratory. As with the other days, I want us to begin with a hymn, and if you could get a copy of the LBW and turn to hymn number 188. Now, there's a reason for choosing this hymn even beyond the particular text. 188 is often attributed to St. Patrick, and that means the 4th and 5th century. I have a thesis that Celtic Christianity pulsates with the power of the universe as manifesting the power of God. Part of this thesis is that this is pre-Augustinian Christianity. This is Christianity where the influence of Augustine has not shaped the faith. And with Augustine, you have a faith in which the knowledge of God is through the mind. One knows God through reason and through the mind. Celtic Christianity knows God through all of the senses and through observation of the manifest power of God in the created order. So I choose this hymn attributed to Francis and ask that we sing only the first two verses. The first verse is binding oneself to the strong name of the Trinity, in other words, to God in all manifestation and all persons. The second verse, I just want you to take note of the images of creation as the place where the power of God is present in, with, and under cosmic energy. And someday in my I will make an investigation of Celtic Christianity and go back to the creeds, go back to the liturgies, go back to the hymns as a part of properly doing a doctrine of creation, which we must redo in these days. It may not be in this lifetime, I may need to do it in the next lifetime, but it'll get done. So, 188. This is another one where you have to stand, you can't sit. Notice that it's you gotta flip the page here. This is the first verse. Publish this. Okay. Don't you like that hymn with a combination of the profession of God and Christ's incarnation, the Trinity, and then immediately juxtaposing that these images of energy in nature, the lightning flash, the great salt sea crashing on the eternal rocks. One just feels both the binding oneself to the power of God and binding oneself to an earth in which the power of God is manifest in the energy of the created order itself. But now I have to shift a little bit the nature of the discussion today. The issue today is not whether power is cosmic, expressed as cosmic energy, or whether the cosmic energy that pervades all of creation is power. That's the most fundamental meaning of power there is. When we said yesterday that nothing happens without power. It means nothing happens without this kind of energy. It's the kind of energy that's present in all of creation. This is more comprehensive than the powers that we've talked about. The powers we've talked about have been social power, been the power in the hands of human beings as they function and shape society. So coercion, we talked about coercion as humanly fashioned and exercised coercion, not the coercion of the volcanoes or the earthquakes or the water wearing away the rocks as it comes down Copper Creek. We talked about social power. When we talked about socialization and ideology, we were talking again about human powers in society. This is a power which is even more fundamental, more comprehensive, more inclusive than that. This is the power imaged in the second stanza. This is the power of galaxies and rocks and plants and water and air and the power of our bodies. This is the power of the universe in evolution. So I'm not, the question isn't today whether cosmic energy is power. Yesterday the question was, is nurture a power? We decided that it was. We don't have a question about that. It's not a question today about the presence of such a power. Without it, all would simply cease. And the question isn't really whether there is a dynamic present that is more primordial or more primary than this. There isn't. The question that I want us to pose today is a different one than we have asked about power this week. The question I want to pose is the question that I put on the board. Ought we to reconceive the power in human hands in view of what we learn from the power manifest in as cosmic energy? Ought we to think about the kind of power we do exercise as human beings in view of the way in which we see power ordered and ordering the entire creation of which we are a part? Another way of saying this is, does creation teach? In terms of the hymn, does God as Creator God and all dimensions of the Triune God manifest a power and a presence through creation in such a way that it instructs us for our use of power in society? That's the question that I want to pose. So it's relating this power to the other powers we've talked about, rather than asking what is nurture, or what is coercion, or what is ideology. Is this power expressed as cosmic energy also a power for direction in our lives, is the way I want to get at this today. And then, as always, to ask the question whether this kind of power, whether we see this power manifest in what we see in the life, death, ministry, resurrection of Jesus. Now, each day I've tried to point to a few resources, and whether I remembered to order them for the bookstore or not, the trouble with doing these things the night before you have the session is that it's too late for book orders at that moment. But if you don't know the work of Thomas Berry, the Roman Catholic geologian, actually, then you should. And I put on the board the title of this book, Thomas Berry, The Dream of the Earth. I think it's in paperback now. Thomas Berry argues that our era is an era in which we need a new cosmology. We need a new way of seeing creation and ourselves amidst creation. And in this cosmology, we need to let nature instruct us as to how we ought to exercise our power as part of creation itself. Now, that's a simplistic overview, but it's enough to say that that fits with our session today, and the best thing that can happen to sessions on holiness provide something for people to follow the sessions with in their own reflection. And I commend to you the work of Thomas Berry in The Dream of the Earth. It's not only a kind of theological explication, but he takes on very practical topics. What does it mean for the education system? What does it mean for how we fashion our cities? So it's a very, he's doing what, in this his kind of work, what I'm asking that we consider, namely whether the power expressed as energy throughout the universe is instructive for how we exercise other forms of power. It's not a new question. It comes to us anew because we've got an ecological crisis on our hands. And so we are forced to ask whether the way in which we have exercised power, including now the heightened impact of that power on that little patch of God's real estate that is the creation that we inhabit, whether it forces us to look at ourselves anew. But the contention that there is a power of God manifest throughout the created order that is instructive for human living is an old contention. It belongs to the religious traditions of most peoples, and certainly to the Jewish and Christian traditions, that God has invested the created order with a moral order that you best not violate, or you bring evil consequences upon yourself. That there are laws in nature that one ought to adhere to, or you render unto yourself evil. Evil is in some instances understood as flowing from the violation of an ordering of the creation already there at the hands of the Creator. Now, Martin Luther King's way of saying this, and he lived from a conviction of a moral order in the universe. His way of saying it was, the arc of the universe bends towards justice. Or another one of his lines, truth crushed to earth will rise again. You can violate the ordering of the universe that is, in the conviction of many traditions, a moral ordering, but you don't fool here with this. It'll retaliate. The Earth talks back, as Time Magazine. Time Magazine substituted for the Man of the Year, the planet, a few couple of years ago, and the title of that feature article was "The Earth Talks Back." You don't fool with Mother Nature is another way of saying it. But it's more than it's more than simply the Earth talks back in the sense that we then have a deteriorating environment on our hands. The conviction of many of the oldest religious traditions is that there, in fact, is a moral order here. It goes beyond environmental. It belongs to the order by which human beings must live. Now, one last comment, a couple more. We mentioned earlier in the week the heightened impact of human power on that creation which is within our touch. Most, the vast vast dimensions of creation are far beyond anything we'll ever touch. We're just a minuscule speck in only one of probably millions of galaxies. So we do not affect all of creation. But in that speck of creation in which we inhabited, as I quoted James Gustafson, the ordering of life has in a sense shifted from God to humanity, and more in this century than in all of the previous centuries combined. So this question of whether there is a kind of moral ordering in creation takes on particular importance for our era, because we affect the fundamentals of creation in more fundamental and pervasive ways than previous generations have. That is a reason why there is a great new interest in the doctrine of creation in all circles these days. That is a reason why we look to other traditions than our own for some assistance. That's why there's a new interest in creation-centered religions. It's Native American on this continent. Let me just read to you the statement of the Toronto meeting called First Nations Conference that was held in 1980 at the behest of the North American Indians of Canada. They made a declaration at this First Nations Conference, meaning they were the First Nations in what is now Canada. 1980. We, the original peoples of this land, know the Creator put us here. The Creator gave us laws that govern all relationships to live in harmony with nature and humankind. The laws of the Creator defined our rights and our responsibilities. The Creator gave us our spiritual beliefs, our languages, our culture, and a place on Mother Earth which provided us with our needs. We have maintained our freedom, our languages, and our traditions from time immemorial. We continue to exercise the rights and fulfill the responsibilities and obligations given to us by the Creator for the land upon which we were placed. The Creator has given us the right to govern ourselves and the right to self-determination. The rights and responsibilities given to us by the Creator cannot be altered or taken away by any nation. I just wanted you to hear a whole way of life focused on Creator and creation. And there is now more attention in Christian circles to that as well. Lutherans aren't particularly well positioned for this, because we have been Christocentric and in our expression of faith, and we always talk first about redemption and then only relate creation to that. We don't go to the first article of the creed first, we go to the second article and then move from there to the first and the third article. So we have some long and hard thinking to do too. One last thing then before turning this to a discussion of the question on the board. I do remind you that whatever our propensities in a Christ-centered faith, that the biblical materials themselves include a lot of materials which insist that creation teaches us, that creation instructs us, quite apart from the drama in Jesus. I'm just citing Proverbs 30, verses 24 to 28, as one example. There are many, many others. Four things on earth are small, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they provide their food in the summer. The badgers are a people not mighty, yet they make their homes in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them march in rank. The lizard you can take in your hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. These are not dumb, these little creatures. Then it goes on, that chapter goes on to talk about negative learnings from creation as well. I won't go through some of those, but I'll just cite another one. This is Job chapter 12. Then Job answered those who were trying to comfort him. No doubt you are the people and wisdom will die with you, but I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? I am a laughingstock to my friends. I who called upon God and God answered me, a just and blameless man, am a laughingstock. In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune and is ready for those whose feet slip. The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. So the righteous are prospering here, and the wicked are prospering, and the righteous are catching it in the neck. Then Job says, okay, that's the way things look among human beings. He goes on to say, but ask the beasts, and they will teach you. The birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or the plants of the earth, and they will teach you. And the fish of the sea will declare to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In God's hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all humankind. Does not the ear try words as the palate tastes foods? Wisdom is with the aged and understanding in length of days. Now, we don't go on there to talk about what one has learned, but the contention that all is not learned that is relevant for human society by talking with one another. All, one must listen to the rest of creation, and it will instruct, it will teach. It's a reflection of this contention or assumption that the created order itself is morally ordered. Okay, that's what the rhetoric texts call an extended introduction. All of this is an introduction. Extended introduction is a bit of an oxymoron. It's like saying a lawyer's brief. But
military intelligence.
Military intelligence, yes. Two questions then, and we'll take them in order. Well, maybe there's one that's prior to this question. Ought we to reconceive the power in human hands in view of what we learn from nature? Let's talk first about what it is we might learn from observing the world, the non-human world about us. Do you see instruction there? Do you see the workings of power in the form of this cosmic energy that has instruction for us? And that'll lead right into the question.
I guess it's a cynical thing, but it seems like what gets noticed and adopted is the ethic of survival of the fittest.
Yeah,
in what is a predatory world sometimes.
Yeah. What's fascinating is the turnaround. Well, first of all, that survival of the fittest was not what Darwin taught. That was taken from Darwin's observation and then made into, refashioned into a kind of law for human society. It was not the contention of Darwin, from whom the phrase is listed, that pertains to the human world. But what's fascinating in the description of the world by biologists now is that does not pertain to the world of nature either. Rather, you have much more in the way of things finding their proper niche and cooperating with the rest of nature around it. When they exceed the limits of their proper niche, then you're in trouble. When they try to take over all that is. So there's just even a nice switch where cooperation and finding one's, recognizing limits and finding one's niche is a better description of the functioning in nature itself. But there's no question that the survival of the fittest has been an image picked up from nature, which has been used to, in this case, become the ideology of a kind of rampaging capitalist order, if you just look at the historical record here. Dan, and then up here.
I just add to that a geological perspective. That's what I like to deal with it. Geologically speaking, one of the things that I'm always struck by is creation always seems to be trying to diversify itself and bring more forms of life in here. And there have been, in geological record, at least 5 major extinctions, where in a relatively small amount of time, over 90% of the life forms on Earth became extinct. And what's so striking is that relatively quickly after that, there's an explosion to new and varied life forms. And the sobering for me is that we're currently in the 6th major extinction right now.
Yes.
And this is the first time that we geologists think that it's being induced by one of the member species itself,
yeah,
i.e. human beings.
Yes. That's the qualitative distinction.
And that, in terms of teaching in a moral order, that we're directly going against what what life seems to be about, which is always creating more diversity and more forms.
Yeah. And living from that diversity. I mean, yeah, that's one of many reasons for the alarm of species at human hands. You reduce the base of life itself for its own flourishing, for our own flourishing.
The sign of hope I always draw from that, although it's maybe not terribly hopeful from a human perspective, but is that after each extinction, the Earth has bounced back and found ways to continue on. So I think your book, this one as well, the question is whether human beings want to be part of that.
Yes. And in fact, in the meditation the other night in Vespers, when I engage in a little bit of preacher's rhetoric in saying the Earth is dying, it was not really a scientific judgment. Gaia, the Earth, will survive and will take some other form, and forms of life will survive. The question is whether the Earth habitable and for human beings will survive the cataclysm that could be brought about by the collapse of planetary ecosystem. Whether it's dying for us.
And lots of other things.
You had your name.
I was going to say something much less profound, but something that kind of flashed on me when we were talking about, you were mentioning about what we can learn from examples in nature. And I had this vision of the honeybees and flowers, where there's a cooperation between the bees spreading the pollen to reproduce the flowers each year. But in terms of like corporate America, what would be our response as a honeybee? We would cut all the flowers down and corner the nectar market, and there would be no flowers the next year. And so we're killing off ourselves. Competitiveness gets in the way of cooperation and perpetuation.
Yeah. E.F. Schumacher makes a very simple but helpful distinction in talking about the relationship of human beings to nature. He says we have to learn to live in economic terms now, on interest. What we're doing is expending the capital. And when you do that, eventually you have nothing which produces interest anymore. That's kind of an extension of your important example.
I was thinking renewal, like seasonal renewal. We see that every year, and then something like, just at Mount St. Helens a couple weeks ago, the renewing of the resources as they're appearing again.
Mm-hmm. Or the fires in Yellowstone. Back here, and then Jan.
Is it not generally true that in creation the creatures do not take more than they need? Which is to say, for example, yes, of course, animals feed off each other, et cetera, but on the whole, they do not, as we tend to do, take much more than we need and store up much more than we have.
The predatory animals don't, they kill in order to eat, but they don't kill more than they eat. A kind of instinctual sense for doing that which fulfills your need, but doesn't go beyond what you need. Yeah. Jan?
Well, this may appear to some of you as triviality, but I've come to the conclusion it isn't trivial. I think we have one of the best teachers in most of us have had them in our households for years, and we've overlooked them, trivialized them, so that they could no longer teach us, and that's companion animals.
Companion animals?
Especially the dog. Best image I know of, if you allow it to have puppies, of God the Creator. But even if you don't allow it to have puppies, it's the best example I know of Christ the servant in every household. And and if you allow
you mean
them
the mother dog is?
Yeah, the mother dog. But also the dog in the household. If you don't spoil it, if you allow it to be a companion animal, not a pet, which I think is a trivializing word, you treat it as a companion, it's the best teacher there is, especially for your children, but for all of us.
One thing about mankind is that he's the only animal that I know so far that's been able to change his nature.
Yes.
And that's a big distinction.
Yes.
Can you recall the bird experiment a few years ago, about 1800 or something like that? They were trying to count the number of birds in a given area of forest. I think it was New England somewhere. And they count so many birds year after year, no matter whether there was hard winters or not. The birds would die from winter. Like, they always had the same number of birds in this area. So they decided, this sounds a bit cruel, but they decided to kill off half the birds. They did. The next year, exactly the same number again. They kill them again, same number the next year. The animals limit their population to what their niche can handle.
So,
and that was the conclusion of this. It's better, killing a lot of birds, but at least they proved the point that, that animals tend to limit their populations to what they can survive on in their particular niche and nature.
I didn't know that.
We change our
niche. Yes, we create, we fashion the niche. We alter the niche itself. Yeah. Thomas Berry is very helpful on this because he sees human beings amidst all the other creatures and tries to talk about that which is distinctive. And he says that human beings are that part of nature which has come to consciousness of itself and of its world, and out of that consciousness then does do some fashioning of the world around it. Shapes and reshapes the niche that we inhabit. But he's alarmed at what we haven't learned from the rest of creation about what we must tend to in shaping and reshaping that niche. There is no place for human beings to kind of move into a kind of romantic innocence, simply inhabiting some niche in which we do not fashion and refashion the world around us. It is the mark of human beings so to do. The question is what, and you're pointing indirect, at least indirectly, maybe directly to the population issue here, as to what the capacity is, what the carrying capacity is for the various kinds of human niches that the planet might permit.
Yeah. Well, start if a man started to settle in communities and started in agriculture. As long as he was a hunter, hunting and gathering, he could only grow so big because he had a certain niche which he didn't change.
Yeah.
But when he started to settle down and started to grow crops, that changed the whole balance of nature in his little area.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one of the dangers today, is that we're relying on a very few species of crops to feed the world.
Yeah.
And if some disease hits those species, and,
it's not listening to the kind of diversity and the
you
propensity
of. You find a diversity of crops, diversity of plants.
Yeah.
We just cut these all down, put down wheat, corn.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I understand that even wheat now, today, we got to change the species every 5 or 6 years, something like that, because it becomes a disease, some kind of a rust or something that attacks the wheat. And new species they develop can survive against this, but they gradually weaken. Constantly upgrading the seeds. We're on the verge of catastrophe.
Any other response? We've moved into this question. Any other response to this question? How then ought we to reconceive the power that is in our hands?
in view of the kind of power expressed in nature as a pervasive cosmic energy that is ordered. The ordering may be a dynamic one. It is a dynamic one. I don't mean a static view of the universe, but it is a dynamism that has order about it. Yes?
Larry, I raise this question. I'd like to rephrase that question from my own perspective. I parent a Down syndrome child. What can I, as a parent, learn from nature about the care of a person who, in the eyes of most, is a mutant, or at least some chromosomal abnormality?
Yeah. Share with us your reflections on that. I mean, being a parent, you've certainly thought about that question.
We have redefined, number one, very basically, what it means to be normal. We have thrown that out of our vocabulary. We have no conception at all of what that means, because Ryan has taught us things that normal people cannot. But on the other hand, he has really pushed us beyond many limits. We have grieved some things, perhaps some of the things we've had to give up are okay. Expectations, again, of a normal child. But very honestly, we're constantly looking for good news. Where is the salvation? Where is the sense of uplifting? And we can cover many things up, but when we're most honest, we're looking for good news. And I'm very seriously asking, what can nature teach me as a parent, caring for Rice?
Well, are there responses to that? Dan, I have some.
I've been sitting here trying to figure out how to phrase this.
Does it follow on, yeah, on this?
Yeah, in terms of our ideology, so often limits how we can even see nature. I mean, we're like the norm stuff. So that our ideologies put these blinders on us so that we can't even see what nature is and what nature has to teach us. And again, that diversity in nature. Our ideologies are really reductionistic. And I get uncomfortable when we talk about like natural law or something, because it's a kind of an intellectual abuse of nature where we use nature to justify how we want to see things.
Can I respond to that, and in response to his question, not by referring to natural law, but to take that question extremely seriously, but answer it in an indirect way. The way in which science describes what theologically we would call creation has at least in the modern era, had terrific impact on the way in which we see our whole world. If you change the scientific paradigm from a Newtonian view of the universe, in which you understand things in terms of really on the metaphor of the machine, to a much more dynamic, evolving universe, you get a different view of all of life. We've just taken an enormous amount of the way in which we see things from science. It filters down or filters around in ways that we don't always call it that, from science. But one thing that has happened is that the changes in the scientific description then break open the ideologies that have grown up, such as survival of the fittest. Doesn't hold now in light of a scientific description of nature. So I think even in answer to your question, what does nature teach us in parenting a Down syndrome child, an indirect reply
is that we learn a whole lot from nature that breaks us open to a different way of seeing things, just as you have as a parent. You question what the rest of us call normal now. That gives you some insights. It probably makes some demands on you as well. Maybe isn't a direct answer to the question, but it's an opening up to other possibilities. Yeah, Dan?
Well, and your question also, I think, has really profound theological implications and things too, which I think opening up the question on nature does as well. Because one of my, the example of a Down syndrome person, when I asked questions about salvation, and particularly the question of a Down syndrome person, it really raises some very profound questions for me about our, some of our traditional ways of looking at salvation, particularly, you know, some of the, when I the people insist that it has to be, you know, like salvation only takes place through a born-again experience where you're aware of what's going on and so forth, and that excludes most of creation. But certainly human beings like Down syndrome or a person who has Alzheimer's or things like that, and I cannot believe that God excludes that part of creation from salvation. Uh-huh. And so it raises some very profound questions for me about how we understand salvation in terms of the wholeness, the saving wholeness of God's creation.
Yeah, and not only for human beings, but for the rest of creation.
That's why I say it really raises the point so that she forces you to look at the rest of creation as well.
Paul, in the Lutheran tradition, we have focused justification by grace through faith entirely anthropocentrically on what it means for human beings, and then it requires an assent to this initiative of God on the part of self-conscious human beings, as you said. I think in the Pauline materials, all creation waits in travail and groaning. And one way to understand justification by grace is that it is God's initiative for the redemption of the whole created order. And doesn't then, and the sort of the triumph of grace is that that happens for the ungodly, in Paul's term. Or one might extend that for all, whether they respond or not. Now let me move. Yes, Krista?
Oh, I just wanted to respond to that. What Dan said, I know a mother, she was a doctor, she had a Down syndrome child, and that was her greatest concern, that these Down children, starting with so old, would understand what the faith and salvation was all about. And he had a beautiful, I mean, he really ministered to her understanding. I talked to her about it. And Corrie Ten Boom, too, the same. She has a whole book about how to teach this to retarded children. So, and they understand it in a more beautiful and, of course, childlike faith than we do, but they have tremendous faith, and they are very special people. I've worked with them. I just love them.
Our time is fleeting here, and I want to, I guess, in the fact we have about 10 minutes left, bring to our awareness some of the traditions in the religious communities which connect here and which relate to Jesus. There is a whole tradition which we are in the process now of rediscovering called wisdom theology. Wisdom theology for Jews has its origins actually in Egypt. And it belongs to a kind of pan-human wisdom. That is, it's not associated with revelatory events that happen only to a particular people, such as being liberated from Egypt, which is fashions the tale and identity of a people. Wisdom theology is about that wisdom which is embedded in the entire created order and is available to all human beings by virtue of being creatures among in the midst of God's creation. The theme of wisdom theology, as it takes form in the Jewish, Hebrew and Jewish community, is a theme which does, in fact, also include their experience of God in the Exodus. And they come to the conclusion that the God that is met in the created order is a good and gracious God, and that there is a giftedness and blessing that pervades all of life, which is expressive of this goodness and this graciousness of God. It's kind of looking for the good news in terms of your question up there, and nurturing the eyes to see the good news that is pervasive of all of life, the blessing that is present as life. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. I used to get angry about that. I thought that was an unfair deal, until I realized which of those two I belong to. Now I say a prayer of thanks every time the rain falls on the unjust, as well as the just. That is, there is this kind of grace that is pervasive of the whole created order that is just impartial. No matter who you are, no matter what your condition is, you participate in it, and it is there. It manifests the bending of the arc of the universe in such a way that it is inclusive. Now, Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza, I don't have time to go to the bookmark that I have here, and in her book, In Memory of Her, Feminist Theological Reconstruction of Christian Origins, is one of the people who is showing that the earliest Christian theology is a wisdom theology. The one word for God in the Hebrew Bible is Sophia. And Sophia, wisdom, is present at the creation. And Sophia, wisdom, is pervasive of the created order. And the contention among some New Testament scholars is that the earliest Christian theology, which is Jewish theology, because the first Christians were Jews, sees in Jesus an expression of Sophia, an expression of the wisdom of God that is available to all. Now, it takes its particular Jewish turn, because the God of Sophia is a God where the emphasis is on including the excluding. So Jesus eats with outcasts. So Jesus gathers all sorts and conditions into his community. So Jesus turns the tables on the normal, what we think of as the conventional differences between the righteous and the unrighteous. So Jesus includes the lepers and the poor and the prisoners, and works towards a community where the goodness of life is lavished without condition on all. Now, it makes for terrific political battles when you start forming that kind of community, but it's an expression of the universe as seen through the eyes of, or in the perspective of, Sophia. The image that I think is a nice one for us now is a New Testament image of the world as an oikos, as a public household. The Greek word for house or household is oikos. Our word for economics, ecology, and ecumenics all share that root. Economics is providing for the material well-being of the public household and managing it well. Ecumenics is regarding all members of the household as a single family and promoting their unity. Ecology is understanding that upon which that interdependence upon which the entire life of the household depends. You have this picture of creation as a single public household, an oikos. Single public household is Martin Luther King's phrase for the planet, but in which there is this kind of weaving of things. That's the picture of creation through the eyes of wisdom literature. And it's a kind of nice picture. Well, I didn't want to lose the point. The point is that there is in biblical scholarship now an attention to Jesus, as in some of the earliest reflections of faith on the part of the followers of Jesus, as expressing Sophia, wisdom, theology. It is in fact not a contention that Jesus is God. It is a contention that in what you see in Jesus is of God, and expresses this that which is manifest in the foundations of the world itself. Now, there are still lots of connections to be made. How does that expression of Jesus as manifesting the wisdom of God in this living as if the world were an oikos, gathering all together in an interdependent way, so that the economic, the ecological, the ecumenical all belong to a single whole. The relationship, what?
How do you spell
oikos?
Oikos.
Yeah.
O-I-K-O-S.
Oikos. When Jesus talks about the servant, no, the steward, who knows what to choose from that which is old and that which is new and put it together in Matthew, Jesus, the Greek word is oikonomos. The word for steward that we translate steward is oikonomos, the trustee of the household. We made, I think, an interesting choice. We chose not oikonomos, but stywarden, the keeper of the pigs. You can do worse. That's the steward comes. Our word steward comes from the Old English, the stywarden. I like oikonomos, but I like pigs too, so there's not a basic conflict here. Now, what isn't yet clear to us, and where the work has to happen now, in my judgment, is now the relationship between power as cosmic energy, as the scientists now describe it to us as functioning throughout nature, and then the question then, what do we learn from the descriptions of nature that is instructive for our use of human power, the connection between that and the connection between the ancient religious traditions which focus on wisdom and what we see in Jesus. I just think there's a whole lot of work that needs to go on between relating the traditions of our faith to the newer descriptions that science affords us. I will draw two conclusions because the bell is going to ring in a moment. One minimal lesson to be learned from power expressed as cosmic energy is that we violate the workings of power as cosmic energy at great peril to our own welfare. The earth does talk back, so we must listen to the trees, the ants, the badgers, the lizards. I know lizards, I put them in your hand, but I know how to live in king's palaces. We must listen, watch how the water flows, see how the understand how the atmospheric gases work. Nature is a primal revelation of the power of God, and we, to our own peril, neglect that revelation. So we need to listen, look, understand, and see how to wield power in society in ways that don't cut against the grain of the power of God as manifest in nature. We may be realizing these days that most of the industrial era is precisely such a violation. That's a kind of minimal lesson. What to watch for now as members of communities of Christian faith, I myself am trying to pay great attention to the wrestling going on in the World Church as expressed in the World Council of Churches. The World Assembly of the World Council of Churches happens next February in Canberra, Australia. Do you know what the theme is? Come, Holy Spirit, renew your whole creation. And then there are four sub-themes: giver of life, sustain your creation, and then some others that focus on human rights and unite your people and so on. I think that's a marvelous theme for exactly where we must now do our theological reflection, because spirit is the way in which wisdom of God has been associated. And there are two things. There's the world body and the church wrestling with how the created order is teaching us these days and how to exercise power in keeping with that, the power that we have. Theologically, it means more and more attention to creation theology and more attention to the third person of the Trinity, the Spirit. What is the Spirit? How does the Spirit move? Because the Spirit is pervasive of creation. This is Spiritus Creator of the opening verses of Genesis. It is also the Spirit of redemption. What is the connection? But it is Spirit that is the place. So, come Holy Spirit, renew your whole creation is where we must give some of our time. In the world of professional biblical scholarship, it is attention to the relationship of Jesus, Sophia, and the Spirit. Again and again, the record says, and Jesus, in the power of the Spirit, went about. What is that power of the Spirit? And what is the relationship of that Spirit to Spiritus Creator that Jesus is tapping? What is the connection between the power seen in Jesus and the power manifest of God in the whole created order and manifest as cosmic energy? I think it's an exciting and terribly important kinds of connection.